Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Daniel Bornstein, columnist and editorial writer for the Contra Costa Times and the Oakland Tribune, and your moderator for tonight's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce someone I've known for many years, Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee, who will be discussing the upcoming California election. A little bit about Dan. He's been a journalist for more than 50 years, spending all but a few of those years working for California newspapers. At one point in his career, at age 22, he was the nation's youngest daily newspaper editor. He joined the Sacramento Union's Capitol Bureau in 1975, just as somebody named Jerry Brown began his governorship. And later he became the Union's Capitol Bureau chief. In 1981, Dan began writing the state's only daily newspaper column devoted to California political, economic, and social events. And in 1984, he and the column moved to the Sacramento Bee. He has written more than 7,500 articles, and his column appears in more than 50 California newspapers, as well as those in other states. Please welcome Dan Walters.
Thank you, Dan. This is Dan. Hello. Despite the ban on noisemakers, I'm here anyway. And discuss a little bit about what's on the ballot. Let me ask you a question. Who's already voted? Well, then you don't have to be here, do you? You've already made up your mind. No, this is, in a way, this is kind of a strange election. Here we are in a presidential election year, and as we all know, the presidential contest nationally is very hard fought, very close. Nobody can predict the outcome, and it has nothing to do with California whatsoever, except that both of the candidates for president do happen to sneak in what they call campaign appearances in California, but they're really just fundraising events because we're kind of like the ATM of politics in California. So that's about our only connection to the presidential campaign. We know what's going to happen in California. Barack Obama is going to win, and we also know what's going to happen in the senatorial campaign. Dianne Feinstein will be elected their 100th term in the U.S. Senate. Nevertheless, there are very interesting aspects and very unique aspects to this year's election in California. And they take really kind of two forms. One is the contest for 153 legislative and congressional seats in this year's election, 53 congressional seats, 8 seats in the Assembly, and 20 seats in the state Senate, since only half the state Senate is up every 2 years. That's one aspect of it, and it has unique aspects. And then they have the second one are, of course, the old grand old California tradition of burying us in ballot measures. This year happened to be 11 of them, not quite a dirty dozen, but 11 of them. And a number of them, most of them, in fact, are very contentious, very controversial, and the outcome of several, the more important ones, is very definitely in doubt. So I'm going to talk about the congressional legislative races first. What makes this year's array of those campaigns unusual are two new aspects of California election law. One of them is the top two primary system that we voted in June, which means that all the candidates for legislative and congressional seats were on the same ballot in June, and the top two finishers, regardless of party, appear on the ballot for a runoff in November. The June election was unusual because it meant everybody could vote for anybody, which meant that independent voters, and that's about 20% of the elected, for the first time really had a say in what went on in a primary election. And secondarily, in 28 of those 153 congressional legislative races, we have same-party candidates running against each other, Democrat versus Democrat or Republican versus Republican, because they were, in fact, the top two finishers. That tends to happen in districts that are overwhelmingly Democratic and voter registration are overwhelmingly Republican. And the theory of those two election law changes, the top two primary and the independent redistricting, I'm sorry, I should mention independent redistricting was the second of those things, Both of them were approved by voters over, I guess you could say, the objections of the political establishment. Independent redistricting means that no longer could politicians basically draw their own districts. Instead of they selecting their voters, the voters get to select them for a change. And the combination of those two things was supposed to create more competition and perhaps more centrism, less extremism in those who are elected to office, particularly in the state legislature. Whether that is those results occur or not, we won't know until after Election Day. But it certainly has created more competition in that you're seeing an absolute welter of very contested legislative and congressional races that we haven't seen in California for literally decades. A number of the older members of Congress, you know, we had a delegation in Congress that had been basically fixed for years and years and years and years, never changing, like, well, Pete Stark, for example. And suddenly, a lot of those older members, more experienced members, decided to retire rather than seek election in new districts under new circumstances of the top two primary. So we have some new blood running for Congress this year, and in many cases, the outcome of those congressional races are in doubt. Not only do you have two Democrats running, Mr. Stark and his opponent, but down in Southern California, $10 billion is being spent by two veteran Democratic members of Congress, Howard Berman and Brad Sherman, are shooting it out against each other in the San Fernando Valley. They're spending like $10 million on that race. A couple of Republicans are running against each other for Congress over in the Inland Empire. So some of these things are happening. This is an unusual thing. It's never happened in California before, and the outcome is in doubt. Going into this year's elections, Democrats had great hopes, because of the way in which the districts were redrawn, of picking up a number of seats in California. In fact, Nancy Pelosi, who aspires to get back and become Speaker of the House of Representatives once again, said that the path to a majority leads through California. The Democrats needed 25 seats to retake control of Congress this year, and they thought they might get 7 or 8 of those seats right here in California based on the maps that were drawn by the Independent Commission. Those hopes have now been tempered down to something more like reality, maybe 2 or 3 seats gained for the Democrats, and it forms the main reason why it's now unlikely the Democrats will, in fact, retake control of Congress in this year's elections, regardless of what happens in the presidential race. It's almost a given in Washington these days that the Republicans will retain control of Congress, and it's almost a given that Democrats will retain control of the Senate. But California then could have played a major role in perhaps national politics through that avenue, but it appears as if it will not. In the legislative side of the equation, the whole game has been over the last year or two speculation about whether the Democrats, who have strong majorities in both houses of the legislature, could in fact get to the point of having two-thirds majorities, supermajorities, and thereby be able to pass tax bills and some other kinds of legislation without any Republican votes whatsoever. That's not going to happen in the Assembly, almost certainly. There doesn't seem to be any prospect of that occurring in the Assembly. They would have had to pick up 2 seats in both each House, 2 in the Assembly and 2 in the Senate. But it's a strong possibility, maybe even a likelihood, that Democrats will, in fact, pick up 2 Senate seats this year and achieve 27, maybe even 28, and thereby have that two-thirds supermajority in the Senate, although it probably will not make much difference in legislation as long as they do not also have it in the Assembly. But the intensity of legislative campaigning this year is focused on 3 Senate races, one in the upper San Joaquin Valley, one in the Ventura area of suburbs of Los Angeles, and a third out in the Inland Empire. Those 3 seats, basically, those three Senate seats will determine whether, in fact, Democrats get two-thirds control in the Senate. Basically, the Republicans would have to win all 3 of those to deny the Democrats that two-thirds vote. Democrats only have to win 1 of the 3 to get the two-thirds vote, so it's likely to happen. So there is where a lot of the money is being spent, in those 3 Senate races and in these very contentious congressional races that are going on, some of which are Democrat versus Democrat, Republican versus Republican, but also a number of which you have Democrats running against Republicans. Out in the just not too far east of here, for example, Congressman McNierney has a very serious challenge on his hands from a man by the name of Ricky Gill. John Garamendi, another Bay Area, kind of greater Bay Area congressman, also faces a fairly stiff challenge. And in the Sacramento area, Dan Lundgren, who's a Republican congressman, is in a fight for his political life as well. And there's a number of those kinds of races in Southern California as well, in which the incumbent is no longer as safe as they used to be when they could control the redistricting of their every 10 years. Now, the other side of the ballot this year that's drawing a lot of interest, and I might add a lot of money, probably before this year is out, something on the order of $200 to $250 million will have been spent on legislative, congressional, and ballot measure races in California. There's almost nothing on presidential races or the Senate race. But on legislative, congressional, and ballot measures, maybe $200 to $250 million will have been spent on campaigns. That's a lot of television commercials, a lot of mail. I mean, I'm sure your mailboxes are full as mine is. And a lot of that, probably most of it, in fact, is going to be spent on ballot measures. There are 11 ballot measures. Number, the 11th one, Proposition 40, relates back to that fight over control of the Senate. It was an effort by the Republicans to block that redistricting plan that could give the Democrats a chance to get that two-thirds vote in the Senate. Mostly they wanted the Supreme Court to step in and block it, subject to referendum. Now that the Supreme Court refused to do that, the Republicans don't care what happens on Proposition 40. Really, basically, is what it amounts to. Nobody cares anymore. Because that was just a kind of a legal ploy rather than truly a political effort. The most controversial of those measures that's on the ballot this year, the one that's getting most attention, is the first one that appears on the ballot, Proposition 30, which is Jerry Brown's tax measure. It would raise sales taxes by 0.25% for 4 years, and income taxes on the upper income taxes, the top 1% basically of taxpayers in the state, for 7 years. And raise approximately $6 billion a year when fully implemented. And he's spending a lot of money. His allies, I say he's spending, it's not out of his own pocket. He's spending a lot of other people's money, mostly from public employee unions, to try to get the thing passed. That didn't look like there would be a terrific opposition campaign, that they were not going to be raising much money, but suddenly they have gotten quite a bit of money. They're going to have maybe $20 million to spend against it. And I'm telling you, I'm going to give you a little piece of news here. In 2 hours and 15 minutes, a poll will be released by the Public Policy Institute of California that will show Jerry Brown's tax measure has fallen below 50% approval rating. It's going to be down. It's down to about 48%. Tomorrow morning, USC is going to release another poll. It's probably going to show the same thing. In other words, that measure is headed downwards. And at this stage, once those measures start to slide, it's going to be very difficult to resurrect that. He's desperately now campaigning, not only personally, making phone calls, doing everything he can to try to keep the thing from sinking further and try to get it up. It's going to be a very difficult thing to do. If you ask questions, if you're interested, but he didn't do a very good job of putting this whole campaign together. And he's going to suffer the consequences as a result, probably. There is another major tax measure on the ballot, Proposition 38, a rival measure sponsored by Molly Munger. Molly Munger is the daughter of Charles Munger Sr., who is Warren Buffett's junior partner in Berkshire Hathaway. He's got a lot of children, and he's given all of his children a lot of money. And Molly wants to spend it on this tax measure because she's an ardent believer in public schools as a civil rights issue and believes the schools are being shortchanged. And she would raise income taxes on just about everybody, raise about $10 billion a year and give it all the schools. Her brother, half-brother actually, Charles Munger Jr., is a Stanford physicist and a Republican. And he's pumped a lot of money into these Republican legislative campaigns, a lot of his father's money, as well as into the campaign against Jerry Brown's measure and for the campaign for another measure, Proposition 32, which would basically kneecap union campaign giving by making it illegal for them to get payroll deductions from their members. It gets complicated after a while. But Proposition 38, Molly Munger's measure, is not doing very well in the polls. She's down somewhere in maybe the low 40s approval rating. She's lower than Jerry Brown's measure is. But she's got a lot of money to spend. She's spending, has spent some of it. Opposing Jerry Brown's measure, there's bad blood between the two. Jerry Brown made one of the mistakes that he made this year was sending his wife to talk to Molly Munger. They did not get along. As a result, Molly Munger said, I'm going to stay in this thing. And she's now spent something around $35 million of her own money on Proposition 38. And it'll probably fail. But in the way, it probably is going to also help take down Jerry Brown's measure as well. There's Proposition 31, which is going down the tubes as fast. Even the people who proposed it aren't campaigning for it. That's supposedly a measure that's going to fix California's government. Yeah, right. You know, English is the only language in which two positives make a negative? Yeah, right. This was put forward by a group called California Forward, which is a kind of a highfalutin bunch of elitists and former politicians and civic leaders, and they had all these fancy ideas how they're going to fix California's government. And then a billionaire who doesn't have a home by the name of Nicholas Bergeron gave them a bunch of money to put this on the ballot. They put it on the ballot, but then they just said, okay, we're going to put it on the ballot. We're not going to do anything for it. And the right doesn't like it because it's kind of a make it difficult to cut taxes. The left doesn't like it because it's kind of a spending limit. It has all sorts of provisions that would change the budget process, make it a two-year budget process and this and that. And all the stuff that they debated, all these academic conferences on how to fix California. But it's going down the tubes. They're not even a campaign for it, and nobody likes it, and so it's going to die. Prop 32, as I mentioned earlier, was something dreamed up by those on the political right to kneecap the unions and kind of retribution for what the unions did 2 years ago to change the vote on the state budget. And it's probably going to fail, too. Last time I looked, the polls, it was about 55 or 56% opposed to it. The proponents spent some money, but not an awful lot. The unions are spending a lot of money, $30, $40 million, so much money, they're not giving Jerry Brown as much money as he'd like to have for his tax measure. So maybe the people who put Proposition 32 on the ballot, who are the same people who want Jerry Brown's measure to go down, are succeeding kind of through the back door of draining the union funds, and therefore probably both of them are going to wind up failing. And so Jerry Brown's measure may fail. Proposition 32 will almost certainly fail. Molly Munger's measure is probably going to fail. Call it a murder-suicide pact, and you have basically the right idea. And then there are a couple of crime measures. Some people say they're pro-crime measures. Some people say it's a common sense. One of them changes the three strikes and you're out law to say that third strike has to be violent things. We got to stop locking up people for stealing a loaf of bread. The other side says, no, your people might have stolen a loaf of bread, but they only got there because they committed all these other crimes before they got to that point. So anyway, that's controversial. And, of course, there's the measure to end the death penalty, which Californian voters have repeatedly ratified over the last number of years. But, of course, we don't execute anymore. We've got 700 people on death row, and probably none of them will actually be executed because they can't even agree on how they would be executed because of the chemicals or injections or rabid dog bites or something. Maybe they should make them sit in the state assembly every year and just listen to the debates, and they would be asked then to be executed rather than face that torture. Then there's Proposition 37. And if anybody understands Proposition 37, good luck. Because it's about as long as the Bible. And it's supposedly going to, it says it's a very simple measure just to put genetically modified foods, labels on those foods so the consumers would know. But there are so many definitions and exemptions. I mean, it wouldn't count for restaurant food, for example. You wouldn't know they put in there, they could put in there modified lizard meat, and you wouldn't know that. it exempts other foods. It doesn't exempt these foods. And there's so many legal mumbo-jumbo in it that there's a great suspicion, probably accurate, that it's basically a thing ginned up so that people can file a lot of suits against people for not following the law that nobody can understand. If this sounds familiar, it may be because it's very similar to Proposition 65, which was back there in the 1980s. In fact, it was written by the same lawyer who wrote Proposition 65 back in the 1980s. And if you're familiar with some of these crazy things, demand letters for ADA lawsuits and all that kind of stuff. It's the same kind of a deal. Now, that's kind of the subtext. Superficially, it's a fight between the organic food industry, which is putting up most of the money to try to pass it, and the traditional food industry, particularly Monsanto, which is putting up money and most of the money to kill it. The opponents are spending a lot more money than the proponents, but right now it looks like it might pass. So who knows? It's definitely a possibility. Now, have I left anybody? Oh, yes, Proposition 39. The third tax measure on the ballot is a measure that would change the way we tax multinational corporations. I could sit here for the next 2 hours and describe to you the background of this thing. It basically, what it does is it changes the methodology, how you calculate the portion of corporate income subject to California corporate taxes. And it does so in a manner that more or less helps California corporations and more or less taxes out-of-state corporations more. But there are a lot of exemptions in those more or lesses. Some California tax corporations pay more. Some out-of-state corporations pay less. In theory, it would raise $1 billion. And the $1 billion would go to basically alternative energy projects. It's the same change in the law that the Speaker of the State Assembly, John Perez, tried to make in the legislature this year to raise money for more money for college students. Same change, just a different outcome. And it undoes a deal that was done in the legislature in 2009 as part of the state budget that year, which undid another deal that was made 15 years before that, which undid another deal that was made 15 years before. It's an issue that's been kicking around the Capitol so long that Jerry Brown had to deal with it during his first term. And it's how you apportion income of corporations for state taxation. He fought the battle. Other governors have fought the battle. It's been changed this way. It's been changed that way. Originally, it was a 3-4 formula of property, payroll, and sales. And then it had the double-weighted sales factor where you counted sales twice as much as property or payroll. And now this would go to a single sales factor in which the only thing that would count is what you said. So if you had a corporation, you did business in California, and you had 10% of your sales in California, then you paid 10% of your income, became subject to state taxation, and your property and payroll would have no effect. Do you understand all that? No, you don't. But you're going to have to vote on it anyway, whether you understand it or not. It's a big change in law. It amounts to about $1 billion. Did I get them all? I think I got them all, so I'm going to stop. Thank you very much.
Nicely done, Dan. Nicely done. Come have a seat. Yeah, get off your foot there and make yourself comfortable. You know, I noticed at the start you talked about top two and redistricting, and you talked about what it was supposed to do.
Yeah.
What will it do?
I have no idea.
What do you think it's going to do if you had to predict?
I think it will produce... For setting aside the changes in Congress, because they really don't amount to much on this thing, this is really all about the legislature. I think it will produce a legislature in which there are a few more moderates in both parties, a few more. Now, whether it's enough more to actually change the tenor of the legislature or not, I have serious doubts, because I think that the polarization of the legislature has causes that are kind of organic, built into the fabric of our system of governance in California. And I don't know that just changing those kinds of things on the margin would be sufficient to actually make the legislature a more effective and responsive body. It's really part of a larger conflict that's been going on for the last several years, and that's whether making California governable, it would change, take a big bang, like a constitutional convention, a kind of a clean sheet of paper. I tend to ascribe to that myself. Or whether you can do it incrementally, you know, a top two primary, an independent redistricting of this. The California Forward Group that put Proposition 31 on the ballot, that was supposed to be the next step in the incremental reform of California after the top two primary and independent redistricting. It's the same group of people who were sponsoring those things. But then they kind of backed. They put it on the ballot, and then they kind of, oh, well, never mind. We'll forget about it. So I tend to think that it might have some changes, some effect at the margins, but it would not change the fundamental ineffectiveness of the legislature as a policy-making body, which is why we have all those ballot measures, when you think about it, because the legislature doesn't work very well. And so people get frustrated at that, and they go out to the ballot and put all this stuff on the ballot. I don't think it will have a very noticeable impact.
Dan, you've watched this for decades now.
Don't remind me. Too damn long, okay. Really.
And I think we would agree at this point that the system's pretty dysfunctional.
I've used that word a few times.
I've used it a few times, too. And we always have to remember it's got a Y in there. Right?
That's right.
Help me understand, is there any way out of this, then?
Is there
really any solution?
Again, we're talking about, here's my theory. Okay, you're going to get the full thing here. Our structure of government, which we adopted in the 19th century based on something that was first created in the 18th century, and then we've modified. We know we have the second longest constitution of any state in the United States. It's been modified 500 times already, not counting the constitutional amendments that are on the ballot this year. It's a unwieldy, unusable document. Parts of the Constitution absolutely contradict other parts of the Constitution. It just doesn't make any sense. And the whole structure of government is based on the theory that we fought a revolution from a king and we don't want to have authority vested in anyone. So we took the checks and balances of the original federalist system that the founding fathers created, and then we put it on steroids in California because we do everything to wretched excess in California. So we create, well, if a little diffusion of authority is a good thing, a lot of diffusion of authority would be a great thing. And I offer as an example of that public education. Does anybody know who's in charge of public education in California? Who do you hold accountable for the outcomes? Is it the governor, the legislature, the state superintendent of schools, the state school board, the local superintendent, the county superintendent, the county school board, the PTA, the California Teachers Association, or who?
And who controls the money?
They all control pieces of the pie, including the money. None of them has ultimate responsibility for outcomes, and you have no one to hold accountable. And that's taking the checks and balances system and putting it on absolutely crazy steroids as much as Lance Armstrong. And we need to simplify that. We need to empower those we elect to office to make decisions and then hold them accountable for those decisions. We have a wonderful system for passing the buck because nobody's really responsible for anything, and we don't have a system of accountability and authority. So we actually need to go back to a clean sheet of paper and say, what structure of government makes sense for California in the 21st century, not something that's been patched and borrowed and so forth. And look, we haven't changed the size of the legislature since the 1860s. Well, if it was right then, how can it be right now? We haven't changed the county boundary in the state since 1907 when Imperial County broke away from San Diego. We need to go back and rethink the whole idea of what levels of government should do what and how should they be organized. Maybe we should think about a parliamentary system. Maybe we should think about proportionate representation and all sorts of things that we could adopt that might make people more engaged and empower them and empower the people they elect to actually make decisions. You know, it's odd, and I think it's a symptom of that. Jerry Brown came into office last year, 28 years after he left his first governorship. And the stuff he found on his desk was the same stuff he left behind in 1983, because it had not been resolved. The same thing, water, transportation, state budget deficit. He dropped a budget deficit on his successor, George McMahon, and he had one dropped on him by Arnold Schwarzenegger. They hadn't fixed the thing. And so that indicates that the structure, the system is not really functioning very effectively. That's a long answer to a short question, and I apologize for that.
Talking about Governor Brown for a second.
I don't know. Education, I guess. Those are the big three.
talking about Governor Brown's measure, Prop 30, you dropped on us a little bomb here tonight that we'll learn about presumably in the papers within the next 24 hours. That is the PPIC poll. And it seems to suggest that it's in serious, serious trouble. We talked a little bit, you and I, before this, about what went wrong. Assuming your prognostication here that it seems like things are real trouble, where did he go wrong?
Well, I think he went wrong conceptually, personally. He looked for the easy way out. He thought he had an easy way. Look, what is it? First of all, his plan doesn't really fix the budget problem in California. It's another patch, another Band-Aid that would kind of semi-close the wound for a few more years. But it does nothing about the structural imbalance between income and outgo in government. And in fact, makes it worse. It makes it worse by part of that measure that they never talk about is a constitutional provision that locks in $5 billion a year in payments to local governments. So he's going to have a constitutional guarantee of $5 billion a year in payments to local governments to be financed out of a temporary tax. That's insanity. It's crazy because it increases the state's reliance on the personal income tax, which is overwhelmingly paid by a few wealthy people. So we're utterly dependent on how well a handful of people, about 150,000 Californians out of 38 million, are doing in the stock market. That's just insanity. That's what they call volatility. Boop, 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 like this. And it makes it worse. So it doesn't really fix the problem to begin with. And then, but he thought it would work politically because its centerpiece was this tax on high-income people who basically tax the other guy. Don't tax me. You know, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the fellow behind the tree. So he wanted to tax the fellow behind the tree. We were the real rich people. Well, the rich people can take care of themselves, but it actually made California's situation, budget situation, worse.
So it would have been bad policy. But what would have been the good politics?
The politics, he should have gone whole war on that income tax and forgotten the sales tax part of it. That's the crazy thing about it, because it's the sales tax part of it, which is a tiny part of the whole thing, is dragging down the rest of the measure. It's only a quarter cent increase in the sales tax. It's about $1 billion a year. But it's dragging down the whole thing because that's the part that people would have to pay themselves, and the opponents are not stupid, and they know the polling data that I know, which shows that part of the thing, paying higher sales taxes, is very unpopular with voters. So all the literature you're seeing is not saying, don't tax rich people. All the literature is saying, don't pass this because it would tax you and cost you more for your gasoline and other costs of living. And that was his tactical error. He thought he was being smart by loading it up with the income tax, but by leaving that small component of the sales tax in there, it's going to kill the thing.
So he would have been better off politically to make it even worse public policy.
Yes. Which shows you the insanity of trying to govern California, does it not?
Which actually brings us to, you segued nicely into my next question, which is, can you help us understand just how many different things we have locked into public policy by going to the ballot box?
Well, you start with Proposition 98, which I'm sure you all voted for in 1988, that said, this is a simple little measure. It just gives the schools the fair share of the state's revenue stream. But it locks up 40 to 50% of the state budget. But it doesn't lock it up. That's the crazy thing about it. It purports to lock it up, but every year they fight a battle over, first of all, only three people in the whole state even purport to understand how it works. And they don't agree.
And I've got to testify, having tried to figure out exactly how it works.
Only three people understand.
I'm not one of them.
The person who wrote it, John Mockler, said he made it so complicated so everybody would have to hire him to interpret it and he could send his children to Stanford University. That's what he said. And it's pretty true. And by the way, he's advising Jerry. He not only is advising Jerry Brown on his tax measure, but Mockler also advised Molly Munger on how to write her tax measure. Same guy who wrote Proposition 98. So Proposition 98 start there. There's maybe 40% of the state budget right there. Then you have essentially the lock-ins, but the ones that we have done as voters, really, that's the major ones, Proposition 98.
You left out a little measure in 1978.
Well, Proposition 13, but that doesn't lock in spending. That's a whole different thing.
Yeah, right.
That's a whole different game, but that's not
well,
lock
but it,
in.
But it does affect our whole grand
finances.
Affects
the whole thing,
yeah,
certainly.
Right, yeah.
But Proposition 13 certainly does affect the overall fiscal situation of California, although not as much as most people think it does. But Proposition 98, which came 10 years later, and then we have the kind of the indirect things. You know, when we pass a three strikes and you're outlaw that locks more people up in prison, that essentially mandates a certain level of prison spending. It doesn't do it directly, but it does it indirectly. And then you get boiled down, and then you have the pension costs, which are locked in because you can't change those, supposedly, although some people are finding out maybe you can. You have your bond costs. When you pass a bond issue, a state bond issue, you're committing the state to spending a certain amount of general fund money to service those bonds. That's locked in. It cannot be avoided. So when you put it all together, there's not an awful lot in the state budget that isn't locked in, because the rest of it is locked in politically, one might say. The rest of it is basically higher education, health, and welfare. Once you get past prison, there's only about four things the state government does: K-12 education, prisons, higher education, and health and welfare programs. Everything else is just minor stuff. That's the whole business. And those things are locked in by the fact that if you don't spend those welfare dollars, then you lose the federal money. And the college stuff is not locked in, which is why college fees have been going up, because it's one of the few things you can actually adjust. And that's why college fees have gone up so much.
There seems to be a great concern in terms of locking in the audience here about what happens, what would happen if both 30 and 38 passed, or what should the strategy be for people who here apparently are concerned about
this? Unlikely to happen, certainly.
Yeah.
It's likely that either one of them will pass, as a matter of fact. The parts that are in conflict, such as the income tax, would be resolved by which one got the more votes. So they both could, you wouldn't pile one on top of the other. The terms of the conflict. But it means the sales tax portion, for example, would go into effect, because there's nothing in the Molly Mungers that has to do with sales tax. How it would affect actual spending is anybody's guess. It would be the courts would have to sort all that out, because she would give her money directly to schools bypassing the state budget, whereas Jerry Brown's money would basically go into the state budget. So how that would sort itself out. The more interesting question might be, what if they both fail? Which is the more likely scenario, in which case you have open war in Sacramento to divvy up the remaining dollars.
Let's go through that scenario, since it's looking more and more likely. What is likely to happen if 30 fails, and certainly even more likely, 38 fails? What happens numerically?
Well, the current law, the current budget says that if 30 fails, then there will be automatic trigger spending cuts, most of which would come out of K-12 education, some of which would come out of the colleges, and a few other, very few dollars out of other things, but mostly out of K-12 education. That's why you see the ad, save the schools, vote for Proposition 30. But it's saving the schools from something that Jerry Brown and the legislature decreed would happen. So it's kind of extortion is basically what it is. But would it actually happen if it passed? Jerry Brown says yes, there's no way he would back off of those triggers. But what happened is that the triggers are in such a way that they are legally questionable, and the school people would go to court immediately, fighting them in court, and nobody knows how that would turn out. And then there's this other problem, is that they're really counting on $8.5 billion this year out of Proposition 30, but the triggers are only $6 billion. So even if they pull the triggers, they still have a $2.5 billion problem. And they have another problem, is that the Facebook IPO was counted on for $1.5 billion, and that's not coming to pass. And then the spending's running higher than they anticipated, and the other revenues are also lower. So what you have then, really, if Proposition 30 doesn't pass, you have about an $11 to $12 billion problem in this year's budget, and nobody knows how they would even begin to approach that. It's a huge gamble. They went ahead and did a budget based on a whole series of assumptions. And it may be that none of the assumptions will come true. The Facebook thing won't come true. Proposition 30 won't come true. All these other assumptions, other revenue assumptions, won't come true. And they're going to have an enormous mess on their hands in about 2 weeks.
Dan, before we go further, I should remind people that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee, who is discussing the 2012 California election. I'm Dan Bornstein, columnist and editorial writer for the Oakland Tribune and the Contra Costa Times. Interesting question here. In the midst of all this, there are things like, for example, we got high-speed rail passed this year. What's going to happen in the midst of all this budget craziness as the finances are going down the tube? Where's high-speed rail going to go?
Well, the high-speed rail, charitably, is expected to cost maybe $60 or $70 billion. The state bond issue is $10 billion. only which of which nine is actually spent on high-speed rail, $9 billion. They got about $3 billion with the federal money, so there's $12 billion. Where's the other $48 billion going to come from? And the answer is no one knows.
But we're going to start building anyhow.
But they're supposedly going to start building, but we'll find out whether they're going to. There's all sorts of lawsuits over it, and nobody really knows whether it's going to happen or not. But also remember that that $10 billion bond issue, once those bonds haven't been issued yet, but once they are issued to finance this thing, then the state general fund has to absorb the cost of servicing those bonds. And that's another piece of the whole budget puzzle.
Locks up more money.
Look, this is the situation right now. The state of California has about $80 billion of general obligation bonds now outstanding, and another $40 billion that have been approved by voters that have not yet been sold, including those $10 billion with high-speed rail bonds. That bond service cost on just that $80 billion will consume about 9% of the state budget next year. And our credit rating is now the lowest of any state in the country. So they're having to ration those bond sales because, frankly, Wall Street doesn't want much more, and we can't afford to service more. So if they throw those high-speed rail bonds out there on the market, that's going to absorb about 2 years of total bonding capacity. The state's school construction bonds issue are now running out. There's local school bonds on the ballot all over the state. But those bonds are supposed to have state matching money, but the state is out of matching money. And if they sell those high-speed rail bonds, there will be no chance of selling any more school bonds for two or three more years. In the end, that high-speed rail thing turns out to be this. You want to build schools, you want to build a bullet train. Because you probably can't build them both under the present situation. So I wouldn't count on buying any tickets on that bullet train anytime soon.
We've got high-speed rail. We've also,
by the way, it's a downer for Jerry Brown because a lot of people don't like that, and that's one of the reasons his tax measure is going down the tubes.
We've got high-speed rail. He's talking about peripheral tunnel now.
Right.
These are big ideas, and we had a question from somebody who reminds us that we had our previous governor had big ideas too. And the question that was asked is, what are the chances for another radical moderate to win state office? What does this mean if these big ideas keep running off the rail?
Well, that's a good question. And by the way, to lubricate that peripheral canal would take another bond issue, maybe $10 or $12 billion, and it would have to also be sold, along with the school bonds and the high-speed rail bonds and everything else. It's I think praiseworthy that governors think big, and they should think big, and they should think about the future. But it seems kind of incongruous that they should be dreaming these big ideas when we have the worst credit rating in the United States, when our budget's 20% imbalanced, when the roads are falling apart for lack of attention. I mean, it's great to have big ideas, but you also got to take care of the workaday stuff, and we don't do that very well in California. It's great to talk about a high-speed rail, but if your car is going to disappear into a chuck hole, that seems to be kind of, it doesn't seem to have your priorities straight. We can build all this stuff, and there is a certain thing in politics that people call the edifice complex. You want to build something big so your name will be on it, and people will remember you. And Jerry Brown has his father's name is on that California Water Project and that aqueduct. And he wants his name on something. He wants, maybe not literally, but he wants people to remember him for something big. And Arnold Schwarzenegger wanted to remember for something big. But, you know, it's kind of foolish to do that when your basics are falling apart. And I think in California, our basics are falling apart. Our school system is not operating very well. Our transportation system is not operating very well. There are other holes that need to be plugged. We need to get back to the idea that there are certain fundamental governmental services that need to be performed efficiently and adequately. And until we do that, we shouldn't be thinking about this other stuff because we can't afford it all. There are limits, after all.
So what does this mean for our twice elected governor, twice in two different lifetimes almost.
Twice elected, but
in two eras, shall we say. Yeah. What does this mean for him politically?
Well, I think Jerry came into the governorship Maybe he had nothing else better to do. He's really never had a job, after all. And he came in the governorship as a kind of a do-over, or what they call in golf a mulligan. You know, he wanted to do it over again and kind of, you know, his first governorship wasn't very successful, mostly because he was young and foolish and overly ambitious. Think about it. He ran for governor in 74. He ran for president in 76. He ran for re-election in 78. He ran for president again in 1980. He ran for the U.S. Senate in 1982. His first governorship was a perpetual campaign. You remember? You were there? Yeah. Perpetual campaign. That's all he ever did is run for something. Well, this time around, he said, well, this time I really want to govern. I'm not going to be out there running for president anymore. So he kind of came back in with the idea of setting, I think, a legacy for himself. And he chose as his legacy that he was going to balance the state budget and show us out of the, take us out of the wilderness of imbalanced budgets that we've been dealing with for year after year after year. But he hasn't been able to do it. He suffers, I think, from the same kind of hubris that affected Arnold Schwarzenegger. The idea, this kind of self-absorbed idea that I'm here, therefore everything is different. Well, no, it isn't. Just because you change the name on the governor's office doesn't mean things have changed in the Capitol. And just because your name is Jerry Brown, he said, don't elect another outsider, elect an insider because the outsider couldn't do it, and I'm the insider and I can do it. But he's been no more successful than Arnold Schwarzenegger, back because the problems of governing California are not the name of the governor, the party in power, or anything. It is structural. It's built into our structure. And just because Jerry Brown's elected and Arnold Schwarzenegger is no longer there doesn't really change anything fundamental. And he has this kind of hubris, and same thing that Schwarzenegger did. And it's foolish because it makes you do foolish things. Because you think you have a bigger ability to influence events than you truly have. And Jerry should have known better. He'd been around. Maybe Arnold Schwarzenegger could be forgiven because he was a newbie. But Jerry Brown's been around. He should know more about it than he did. He seems to be very surprised that the Capitol doesn't work. I mean, where's he been all this time? And it's just odd. So what happened? I don't know. I think he's a very disappointed person. And I would not be surprised if this measure fails. I would not be surprised that he doesn't run for election again in 2014. I have no inside information. I don't know. But I would not be surprised, because why would he want to then preside over just budget cuts, budget cuts, budget cuts? Because this economy isn't about to boom again. And you're not going to get any big surge of revenues out of the economy. And so you have this structural imbalance of billions of dollars more of spending commitment than you have money to cover it. And it's not going to go away.
Let's touch on that for 1 second and then come back to the governors. But you raised an interesting point just there. There's this constant echo chamber I keep hearing, and maybe you hear it too, of people in Sacramento and in local government who are saying all you need to do is have an economic rebound and all these problems are going to go away. True or no?
Well, they don't go away because of these built-in spending structures that we've adopted. You get a surge in revenues, it's more or less spent automatically, so they don't go away. But more importantly, we're not going to get this big boom. There's nothing on the horizon to indicate California's economy is going to boom. If you look at the California economy over the last 3 decades, what you have is 3 booms and 3 busts. In the 30 years since Jerry Brown was governor the first time, we had the defense boom of the 80s, followed by the end of the Cold War and the great defense bust of the early 90s, and the worst recession since the Great Depression until this recession came along. And then we had the high-tech boom of the 90s, followed by the high-tech bust of about 2000. And then we had the housing boom of the aughts, followed by, well, we know what happened there, right? Another bubble burst. So we've always had this kind of boom and bust mentality in California. And we said, oh, just another boom just around the corner. We just hold on long enough. Well, there is no boom around the corner. There's nothing to indicate. I read economic forecasts constantly, and there's nothing to indicate other than, at best, a very slow recovery from this recession. We lost 1.3 million jobs in this recession. We've gotten back so far over the last couple of years 0.3. We're still a million jobs short of where we were 5 years ago. And at that point, we already had a million unemployed 5 years ago, so now we've got 2 million unemployed. And there's just nothing out there that says there's going to be any kind of boom. We have a global economic slowdown. The rest of the country is not rebounding very smartly. We have pockets of prosperity, particularly around the San Francisco Bay Area and the high-tech industry. But you look at the rest of the state, we're still in recession everywhere else in California. And there's no boom in sight. And without a boom, you're not going to get any surge of revenues at state and local government. They're going to have to slog it out. And they just don't want, as you say, don't want to admit that. They don't want to look at that and say, God, we've really got to face reality. Because they figure that if we can just stave it off, if we can just kind of get by another year, do another get-out-of-town budget in Sacramento, then maybe things will be better next year. And they keep plugging into the budget these optimistic revenue numbers that don't happen. You know, we're going to get $1.5 billion out of Facebook. Oh, boy, there's $1.5 billion we don't have to cut in spending. Well, is $1.5 billion going to show up? No. But they got out of town. They got an out-of-town budget. They got their paychecks because they delivered a budget on time. Yeah, but on time and a piece of junk, basically.
Dan, you've watched many governors now. Can you think of a time, and many legislatures for that matter, can you think of a time when we didn't budget like this? I have this memory or this notion, and maybe it's my own historical ignorance or misconceptions, that there was a change. And I place it about the late 90s, where we suddenly started budgeting in a way that we didn't budget before.
I think you're right. We started down that path to a certain extent after Proposition 13. What happened immediately after Proposition 13 in 1978? Not only did the state step in and take over financing of schools and some local government functions, what is known in Sacramento as the bailout, but another thing happened. Jerry Brown talks about number one, oh, we stepped in, we took care of it. He doesn't talk about the number two thing happened, and that is because they were in total and utter panic in Sacramento. They passed a state tax cut that same year after Proposition 13 passed. The immediate effect of that was to throw the state budget into an immediate operational deficit. And they financed it out of the reserve, out of the surpluses that had been built up in the 1970s for a few years, and then Jerry Brown walked out the door in 1983 and gave George McMajan a deficit. And we've had that problem to a certain extent ever since. But you're right. It really got bad in the late 90s. What happened? Well, Duke Majan was tough. He balanced the budget. Pete Wilson balanced the budget. They took the heat. They did the spending cuts. They raised taxes, both of them. They balanced the budget. And then came along Gray Davis and this kind of anything-goes era. And so they passed, and you're very more familiar with it than I am, big increases in pensions for employees. Jumped up when the stock market, when the NASDAQ crashed with the high-tech boom in the 2000 and the high-tech collapse in 2000, the state got a one-time windfall of $12 billion in the 2000-2001 fiscal year. And Gray Davis stood up in public right there before the Capitol Press Corps and God and everybody and said, it would be a mistake to spend this windfall. It's a one-time thing and we won't do it. And he turned right around. He and the legislature spent $8 billion of that $12 billion one-time windfall on permanent spending and tax cuts. And next year, the budget had an $8 billion deficit, and it's been in deficit ever since. You're right. That's when it happened. And it's been that way. So we permanently then restructured state government to spend more than the revenue system could produce, even when the economy was doing well. We were running deficits. When the economy does poorly, the deficits get bigger. But there is a structural imbalance. We have committed ourselves as voters, the people we elect to office, to spending more than the revenue system can produce. And that's the structural imbalance, and it's been there for the last, 12, 13, 14 years. And until you deal with that, and Jerry Brown's tax increase wouldn't even close that, by the way. It would only close it partially. Until you deal with that and recognize that reality and stop this wishful thinking, well, we can just get by another year. Now, how do they get by year after year with that? They borrow money. The state, over the last half decade, has borrowed $35 billion, most of it off the books, to cover these deficits in the state budget. Jerry Brown calls that the wall of debt. Now, where'd they borrow that money? Well, some of it they borrowed from banks. Some of it they borrowed from the schools by simply putting that on the money owed to the schools on the credit card. That's about $13 billion of it right there. Some of it is just postponed in other ways. Some of it was borrowed from local governments and whatnot, but there's $35 billion just in the last half decade to cover those deficits.
And I would argue, if I may, that actually they've borrowed much more than that by running up unfunded liabilities on the retirement plans.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. In addition to which, they ran up unfunded liabilities in the retirement. Hundreds
which are
of billions,
actually
hundreds
much
of
greater
yeah,
in,
hundreds
in
of
dollars
billions
and
of
cents.
Dollars. So there's not just a wall of debt, there's a mountain of debt. We're immensely in debt in this state. We're hugely in debt. You take bonds, you take unfunded pension liabilities, you take off-the-books debt, it's probably somewhere between a, and your local government, you know, redevelopment debt and all that, you're looking at something between a half a trillion and $1 trillion of debt that we have run up, mostly in the last 15 years. And it's a mess. And the legislature after legislature and governor after governor has basically ignored it.
And so if some of you would like to ask a few questions after that notion, line up at the mic and we'll take a couple questions as we're winding up this conversation here. The person in the audience asked, and you sort of touched on this before, but so constitutional convention, I mean, you talked about what you sort of favored. Talk about your scenario of what might
well,
happen.
Well, there is a provision in state constitution allowing for a constitutional convention, but it can only be called by the legislature after asking the voters whether they want to have one. We haven't had one since the 1880s. Last time the legislature asked for one was in the early 1930s. The voters said yes. The legislature refused to call it anyway. A constitutional convention is simply a method by which we would rewrite the Constitution and make it put it in more rational terms. Is it a guaranteed success? Absolutely not. Some people say, well, if you had a constitutional convention, maybe they'll legalize marriage with dogs. And the answer is everything that would have gone on that convention would have to be ratified by voters anyway. So what do we got to lose? We really have nothing to lose. The only certainty is if you keep down the path we're on, it's a path to total chaos. And I think there's a price to be paid for that ungovernability, and the price will be economic.
So are you essentially saying it can't get worse than this?
We can't get worse. We know what the situation is. It just gets worse each year. So what do we got to lose by having a constitutional convention and try to straighten it out? I think we have nothing to lose and everything to gain, personally.
Yes, sir.
Dan, could you talk about any of the rising stars who might be making a major impact on policy in Sacramento or statewide politics?
Nope. Because I don't think there are any. I think there are ambitious politicians who would like to do this and that. I mean, Kamala Harris would like to be governor. John Chung would probably like to be governor, things like that. Dave Jones wakes up in the morning and hears hail to the chief, thinks he should be president or something. But that doesn't mean anything because it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. It's the structure. It's the structure that is at odds with the reality of this state. And until we put the structure of governance in synchronization with the reality, this very diverse, very complicated state, then we will be ungovernable. The man on a white horse doesn't exist. There is no man. There is no white horse. We have to understand our malady. And like any illness, the first step to cure is to accept that we are ill. We have civic illness. It doesn't work. It's dysfunctional. Doesn't work, can't work, won't work. And when we recognize that, and I said, I think we'll recognize it if, in fact, our economy doesn't come up. If the rest of the country comes out of recession and we don't, I think then we'll have a better idea that we have made ourselves not only ungovernable, but we've made ourselves inhospitable to the tens and hundreds of billions of dollars of investment capital that would be required to truly bring us out of recession. And maybe we'll then understand that our failure to govern ourselves, just as in Greece, has a consequence, and the consequence is economic.
Dan, let's follow on that notion for a second in Sacramento. Can you think, or let me rephrase that. As you look at the people in Sacramento governing, in the legislature especially, do you think they understand what they are approving day in and day out?
No, they don't. One of the things that's occurred over this stretch of time that I've been in the Capitol since 1975, dating roughly from, you know, through Jerry Brown's first governorship, is a decline in the intellectual level of those who serve in the legislature. We used to have some really smart people in the legislature. But the system has become so dysfunctional that really smart people don't want to participate in it. So what do we get? Our slugs. We get people who get tapped on the shoulder and saying, you're it for a while. Go up to Sacramento and be a legislator for a while. They don't have no idea what they're voting for. They don't want to know what they're voting for. They know how they're told to vote, and they vote that way. They're told by their leaders. They're told by the interest groups outside. They just do that. It's a great life in Sacramento. You get to go to a lot of parties. You eat a lot of shrimp. Collect your per diem.
High cholesterol.
And you go by home. You got to take out the garbage. It's much a lot more fun to be in Sacramento than it is to be at home. So people want to be there, but they really don't want to do the work that's required to make effective public policy. They want to deny reality. And because it's easier to deny reality, in part because they're not going to be there very long with term limits. You know, I'm going to be here for 6 years. I don't care what they do. I'll be gone by the time any of this comes home to roost. So they have this very short-term expedient mentality, and they really, for the most part, have no idea of the ramifications or the consequences of what they do, and they don't want to know. Mostly, they don't want to know.
Yes, sir.
It is my understanding that the state of California is not allowed by law to file bankruptcy.
That's true. You
know, what happens if we run out of money and can't meet payroll and default on the bonds?
We probably won't default on the bonds because the way the Constitution is structured, bonds have the highest priority. It and schools have the highest priority on the revenue stream. It's things down the pecking order that would be let go and are already being let go. I mean, look at what's happened in college tuition, for example. Other things get let go. The state becomes functionally insolvent at some point, and maybe already is. And it has to deal with it because there is no provision for bankruptcy for states and federal law. There is for local governments, but not for states. So it just becomes functionally insolvent and more dysfunctional than it is now. It cannot discharge its debts. It basically has to eventually, because if and when Wall Street cuts off the money, which is what happened. Because, you remember, they have to go out and borrow money every year for operational purposes. Like farmers, they spend money all during the year but only get it in a short period of time. So they borrow operating funds called revenue anticipation notes throughout the year. And we're already paying high interest rates on those, right? Relatively high interest rates, even though it's a low interest rate period. But when Wall Street finally says no more because we don't trust you, then that's when they'll have to deal with it, probably.
Let's follow with that concept, because what you're talking about is the short-term borrowing.
Yeah.
But at a certain time, doesn't the long-term borrowing and the long-term unfunded liabilities start to also squeeze the whole thing?
They squeeze it, but they can't avoid those obligations. You know, those are built into the Constitution. General obligation bonds have an extremely high call on money in the state constitution.
Yeah, no, it's not. My question isn't that they won't get paid, but at a certain point they're growing and taking up more and more.
They take up more and more. Yeah, it's 9% next year. It's one of the highest rates of the country. And bond service, our bond service costs will be one of the highest percentages of our budget of any state in the United States next year, almost 9%. And if Jerry Brown's measure goes down, it'll be even higher because the whole level of spending will go down, so the percentage will be even higher. And they've reached basically the limit. We're bonded up to the max. We can't. They have to ration the bonds they sell in the market now because, frankly, the Wall Street doesn't want much more, and they can't afford more.
So to summarize, we've got we've squeezed out a huge part of the budget on education. We've squeezed out indirectly a huge part of the budget on prisons. We squeezed out a huge part of the budget on bond debt.
There's more there than there is there. You know, it's like the producers. You know, they sold more than the thing really was, and the voters and the politicians have committed ourselves to more than the revenue system can produce. And if you add another bond issue for high speed rail or something, it just adds it that much more. And there is no elasticity in that thing. They're already to the point. I mean, they're stiffing the schools. And the schools are, you know, they go to court. The judge says you got to give them the money. We say, well, we don't have the money anyway. We're not going to pay it. You know, it's a mess. It's a bigger mess than anybody really knows. It's certainly a bigger mess than anybody in Sacramento wants to acknowledge. It is a total mess. But it is only symptomatic of the larger dysfunction of state government. And a big symptom of it, but it's still only symptomatic of that larger dysfunction. Because you see the same thing in any other policy area as well. This kind of can't get there from here kind of thing that goes on.
Well, on that happy note, I guess we should wrap up.
All right.
My sincere thanks to you, Dan Walters, for your remarks here tonight. We also want to thank our audience here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Dan Bornstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.